Okay, so now we are coming towards the very end. And the very end, as always, is really just the beginning, because, of course, once you come to the end of this retreat, once you know everything you have to do, that's when the hard work starts, to actually apply these things as well, right? So there's no, sometimes you just have to keep going and see what happens. Anyway, so here we are heading towards the end of this retreat anyway. And we're going to finish off the Giri Mananda Sutta and look at all these perceptions. And as I was saying, the idea here is that actually just working with perception itself is really enough to take you to all the way to the end of the path. If you understand those perceptions that should not be developed, and you understand those that should be developed, and you understand, so then you know how to move forward at any time, basically. So we're going to, the next one here in this list is the perception of abandoning. And this is a very common perception in the suttas, and I think quite an important one. And it goes as follows. Here a bhikkhu does not tolerate an arisen sensual thought. He abandons it, dispels it, terminates it, and obliterates it. He does not tolerate an arisen thought of ill will, an arisen thought of harming, or maybe of being ruthless or something like that, any bad, unwholesome quality whenever they arise, he abandons them, dispels them, terminates them, and obliterates them. This is called the perception of abandoning. So very strong words there, right? Terminating kind of reminds you of certain movies when you see that. It's very strong words, and so it means that obviously we're trying to really abandon these things very thoroughly. That's what it means. And one of the important points here, and one of the points that you see when you read the sutra, where the Buddha talks about his own practice, his own awakening, is that when he uses strong words like that, he doesn't mean, as I was saying before, he doesn't mean willpower. It sounds like willpower, right? It sounds like brutal force to abandon these states of mind. But if you use willpower, all you really do is you suppress them, you kind of hold them down. And as soon as you relax a little bit, they kind of come back up again, often with a vengeance, much worse than before. So if you really want to obliterate a bad thought, the only way to really do that is by wisdom, by understanding that it is dangerous, by reflecting on it in the right way, thinking about it in the right way. And when you see that with wisdom, when you understand these things, then the bad thought can often just disappear just like that. It's like it really, really is obliterated in a very real, much more real sense than if you suppressed it or just hold it down by willpower. So remember that. All you have to do is shift your attention. You see the bad qualities in somebody. You can see if I continue down this way, ill will is going to arise. So you shift your attention to the good qualities. Or you remember that they're just a conditioned human being. What do you expect? So you get compassionate instead, right? And with that shift, just remembering the Dhamma, remembering the reality of things, it's astonishing what you can do with the mind just by something simple like that. And for most people, the most important things to abandon is ill will. Sensual desire is a much more deeply rooted defilement and much more difficult to abandon. So if you can, for all practical purposes, work on reducing anger, reducing ill will, negativity towards other people. If you can do that much, you're already doing really, really well. And then the sensual desire is a bit more, it takes longer and more complicated. But some of the suttas I talked about here, especially the one about all the similes of sense pleasures and sense objects, that can be useful to consider sometimes, and also the death contemplation itself. Somebody asked me whether there is a sequence here. Is there a sequence? You know, it says here, you abandon them, you don't tolerate them, and then you abandon it, then you dispel it, you terminate it, and then you obliterate it. Is there a sequence to these terms, or are they more like synonyms? I think maybe tiny bit of sequence in the sense that I think not tolerating comes before abandoning. So first of all, you don't tolerate. Okay, I'm not going to accept this, right? That is the first thing you have to think. And then you move on to the abandoning. But I think, I don't know, I think it is hard to make much distinction between abandoning, dispelling, terminating, and obliterating. If you look at the Pali, they're very closely related to each other here. And this is how the suttas often are. They often use lots of synonyms, lots of, you know, phrases that are almost identical one after the other. And the reason for that is because it is an oral instruction. It was passed down through oral tradition. And because of that, they used synonyms to kind of make it more stable, more clear, exactly what was passed on, so people wouldn't forget. If you have four synonyms, it is very unlikely it will get corrupted. If you have one word, the corruption can happen much, much more easily. So it's always important with the suttas to remember their oral origin, because then you can understand some of the kind of unusual features of this of the suttas. Okay, so that is the abandoning perception of abandoning. And of course, that is an important one. Here you will notice it does not say that you have to go to an empty hut or anything like that. So this is something that we should always do in all times. We should kind of try to abandon these negative states of mind. So this is always true, essentially. Okay, so I hope that makes sense. So then we come to some very profound perceptions coming up now. The next one is called the perception of dispassion. And what, Ananda, is the perception of dispassion? This is viraga in Pali. Here, having gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, a bhikkhu reflects thus. This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling of all activities, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the ending of craving, dispassion, nibbana. This is called the perception of dispassion. So dispassion here is basically a synonym for giving up of craving, right? The opposite of passion. Passion here in the broad sense of meaning any kind of desire. So it is the opposite of craving, dispassion, the abandoning of craving. And here again, we have the phrase again about going to the forest. So again, it means this is profound, right? It's something you do after samadhi or in conjunction with samadhi practice. This is deep insight, essentially, into understanding where true happiness is to be found in the world. And all of these things that you see here, they are really synonyms for nibbana itself. Remember that nibbana in the suttas, the most common use of the term in the suttas, is the term, it actually means the ending of the defilements themselves. So it is this, like the state of being an arahant is nibbana. There's no defilements there. That's really all it means, because nibbana means to extinguish something, right? Because, and what you are extinguishing at this point when you become an arahant is all the defilements of the mind. So that is what nibbana means, that preliminary extinction. Often people think nibbana means what happens after the arahant dies, but really it means, the most common meaning is what happens to the arahant during this life. And that is what is going on here, which is very clear, because all of these things refer to somebody still being around. So you have, this is peaceful, this is sublime, right? This is kind of the Buddha's understatement. When he says this is peaceful, it doesn't mean, oh yeah, I have a little bit of peace in my meditation, oh, so peaceful. No, it means this is really peaceful. When he says this is peaceful, he usually refers to the highest kind of peace. This is sublime, this is panita, same kind of idea again. It doesn't mean a little bit of sublime, it means like the maximum. When the Buddha talks about happiness, he says, ditta dhamma sukha vihara, dwelling in happiness in this very life. He means the jhanas, it doesn't mean any kind of happiness. And this is one of those things you have to think, be used to when you read the suttas of the Buddha. They are always understated. When he says something, he usually means to the highest degree. And that's important to keep that in mind here. So what is this highest peace, the highest kind of sublimeness, of sublimity or whatever it is? It is the stilling of all activities, sabbe sankhara samataha. And this, of course, returns us back to dependent origination again, right? Sankharas is the second aspect, the second factor of dependent origination. So here we have stilled all those sankharas. You have broken through avidya, the ignorance, the delusion. And because of that, the volitional activities, the willed activities, they have ceased as a consequence. You're not going out seeking rebirth, seeking happiness in the world. You're content in the present moment. You're just mindful. That's the arahant. So all those activities, so you can imagine you live a very peaceful life, right? The mind isn't active, isn't always creating things, always trying to produce the future. Instead, you're just content and happy in the here and now. What a very peaceful existence. Sabbe sankhara sammata doesn't mean that all the activities of mind have stopped, but only kind of the major ones. There's still little aspects of volition left, like what is sometimes called functional volition. That's a term from the Abhidhamma, the commentaries. But it means, you know, there are certain functions in life that you have to perform, like looking after the body and this kind of stuff. But those strong volitions, the cravings, the things that drive samsara and rebirth, that has all come to an end. And that is what is meant by this. And this is the sankhara of the second factor of dependent arising. Sabbe sankhara samatha, all activities, all this, the will which drives you around, the kind of the slave driver in a sense, has come to a halt. No more being slaved around by craving, as we saw the other day here. The relinquishment of all acquisitions. Acquisitions is everything in the world that we try to take up and hold on to and attach to. That is acquisitions, right? All of that stuff. Upadi is the Pali word for acquisition. And upadi means everything we own, right? So it refers to ownership, everything we own in the world, including relationships and all that kind of stuff. But it also refers to the ownership, internal ownership, regarding ourselves. Our sense of identifying with the five factors of existence, right? The five khandhas. That is also ownership. I own this body. This is my body. I want to control it. I own these feelings. These are my feelings, my perceptions. This is my will. I do things, etc., etc. So it goes to the very core of ownership, to the very root of what we mean by ownership. So it's very, very deep in that sense. So, of course, you relinquish all of that. You have no sense of ownership anymore. No sense of having anything which is yours. No acquisitions. You've given it all up. So this is also an aspect of arahantship, of giving everything up. No control at all anymore. And in a strange way, when you have no control, that gives you the highest control, in a sense. Because that means you have access to the dhammas. You have access to all the happiness which you want. So by giving up control, you actually get what you want. The destruction of craving, tanhakaya, the ending of craving is really what it means. Destruction is a bit brutal kind of word. It means really the ending of craving, right? No more craving, no more slave driving. Dispassion, viraga, the end of craving again. Nibbana, extinguishment, the extinguishment of all the defilements. This is called the perception of dispassion. So the idea here is to see, is to kind of look at this and to reflect on it and to see it as something wholesome, right? Something good, something very desirable, something incredibly happy. That is really the idea here. And when you reflect on this as something very happy, very desirable, then the mind moves in that direction and you start to direct your mind in a different way. Of course, this is really, you can only fully understand what is going on here until when you become an Arya yourself, when you become a noble one and you've had insight, full insight into the Buddha's teachings. Only then can you really understand this. In the meantime, you have to have some kind of preliminary understanding here. And that, of course, is also helpful. Okay, then we have the perception of cessation. And what is the perception of cessation? It is exactly the same as the previous one, with one single difference. You have the word cessation instead of dispassion. And what, Ananda, is the perception of cessation? Here, having gone to the forest, to the root of a tree, to an empty hut, a bhikkhu reflects thus. This is peaceful. This is sublime. That is the stilling of all activities, the relinquishment of all acquisitions, the destruction of craving, cessation, nibbana. This is called the perception of cessation. And here, cessation refers to the ending of craving, the cessation of craving. That's what it means here. It is in place of viraga, which previously meant dispassion, right? The ending of passion, etc. So let us go on to the next one. And what, Ananda, is the perception of non-delight in the entire world? Here a bhikkhu refrains from any engagement and clinging, mental standpoints, adherences and underlying tendencies in regard to the world, abandoning them without clinging to them. This is called the perception of non-delight in the entire world. So here the point is that you abandon all your attachment, all your adherence, kind of all sense of relying on the world, right? You don't have any, you don't rely on that anymore. You're not attached to it. You don't adhere to anything in the world. That's the idea here. That's really all it means. And also the underlying tendencies to that, you abandon that as well. So this is the opposite of desiring the world. Desiring the world means desiring existence. It's the same thing. Because it's through existence that you experience the world. So here you're going away from that. So again, very profound, right? But you can, again, it's a gradual thing. You move away from the world. The world is very complex. It's very, very multifaceted. So you start by abandoning the coarser things in the world. And gradually you get to the point where everything is abandoned. You have non-delight in the entire world. And instead, what do you have delight in? Instead, you have delight in those previous perceptions. This is sublime, this is peaceful, with the stilling of everything here. That is where your mind inclines instead. Because the mind has to incline somewhere, otherwise you can't just abandon everything and then not have anything else to incline towards. You have something, you need to point the mind towards something so that you have some kind of, like a refuge, if you like. Like the Buddha who takes the Dhamma as his refuge and respects the Dhamma in the same way. We have to have something that we can kind of guide us, otherwise it becomes impossible. Okay, so next perception here. And what, Ananda, is the perception of impermanence in all conditioned phenomena? Here, bhikkhu is repelled, humiliated, and disgusted by all conditioned phenomena. This is called the perception of impermanence in all conditioned phenomena. So this is very unusual one. It's not really explained like this anywhere else in the suttas. But the idea here is that when you see all conditioned phenomena are sabbe sankhara, right? Everything that has been made come into existence. Maybe you are getting a bit confused now, because just before I talked about the stilling of all activities, which is also sankhara, and here you have the impermanence of all conditioned phenomena, which is also sankhara. So what is going on here? And what is going on is that sankhara means two things. It means the creative activity in the mind, right, which drives rebirth. That is sankhara. So all the activity, all the volition, all the will, all that things. And it also refers to the things that are created by those sankharas. In other words, experience itself. So here it refers to the created things, the things that arise as a consequence of all the volitions and all the willing here. So all these conditioned phenomena, all of them are seen as impermanent, right? We were talking yesterday about seeing the five aggregates, the five factors of personality as impermanent. That was one of the perceptions we looked at yesterday. And this is very similar to that, because the five aggregates and all conditioned phenomena are basically the same thing. There is no difference. So you start to see that in the same way as I was explaining yesterday. You go into peaceful meditation, you see things are impermanent, you see things ceasing, coming to an end, and impermanence gradually becomes, you start to understand what it's all about. And then the consequence of that, it says here, is that you are repelled and humiliated, even disgusted by these things. Very strong terms. But the idea here is that when you see that something is impermanent, when you see it deeply, you withdraw your interest, you withdraw your attachment, you withdraw your desire from those things, because you know they cannot provide you with any lasting satisfaction and any lasting happiness. It was like we were talking about that simile of the hot plate, right? If you put your hand accidentally on the hot plate, you don't have to think whether you have to remove it or not. It's an automatic reaction of the body. It withdraws the hand when you make a mistake like that. And in the same way, here the mind withdraws from samsara. It turns away because it sees the problem. It sees the suffering very clearly, and it withdraws from that. And that is why that such strong terms are used, right? You are repelled by it, humiliated. Humiliated is, I'm not really sure, it usually has a different meaning. It's slightly strange to use the word humiliated there, but you probably get a rough idea what is meant. And even disgusted, right? Oh no, I just can't take it anymore. You have to move in a different direction. So the perception of impermanence in all conditioned phenomena. These are very profound things, right? Be careful not to just take it on board, shrug your shoulders if you can't make any sense of it. But it's interesting that these things were actually spoken by the Buddha in this way. And sometimes it's interesting just to kind of stretch ourselves a little bit and look at some of these more profound teachings and see where it is all going if we get the practice right. And now the last perception mentioned here is actually mindfulness of breathing, anapanasati, which seems a bit out of place considering all these really profound things we've just been looking at. But there you are. Sometimes you get these strange sequences in the suttas. I'm not going to go into why that might be the case now, but here we can have a look at the mindfulness of breathing. We can have regard that perhaps as a bit of a summary of the things we have been looking at over the past 9 days or so. So let's have a look at the mindfulness of breathing in a little bit of detail, because we have time for that. So this is how it goes. And what, Ananda, is mindfulness of breathing? Here, a bhikkhu, having gone to the forest, to the foot of a tree, or to an empty hut, he sits down, having folded his legs crosswise, straightened his body, and established mindfulness in front of him. Just mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Okay, so that is perhaps the most important paragraph in the whole explanation of mindfulness of breathing, because it tells you what you have to do, what you have to get right for the mindfulness of breathing to be possible. This is how you get yourself established, right? And if the establishment is right, if you do the right things to begin with, the rest is pretty much a natural process. It happens by itself. And that's so wonderful when it's a natural process, right? All you have to do is sit back. All you have to do is to have awareness and clarity and see the breath as it is there. That's all you have to do. And then that just happens on its own. But for this to happen on its own, you have to get the preliminary steps right. So, again, the idea is that you have to go here to the forest or to an empty hut or whatever, because now we're getting into mindfulness of breathing is all about samadhi, all about getting into deep meditation, right? So you'd have to do this in the right place for it to have really profound results. You can also do it in ordinary life, but the results will be far less significant. So you go to the forest, and then you sit down, right? Mindfulness of breathing is a sitting down meditation. The real samadhi meditations are always about sitting down. Having folded his legs crosswise, right? This is why many people like to sit cross-legged. Often you get the perception that when you sit cross-legged, you feel this is the real meditation posture. It's like a psychological conditioning that we have, that when you sit cross-legged, you are really meditating. But I think that's all it is. It's just a psychological conditioning. It doesn't mean you can't do the meditation on a chair. You can. I know people who do it and get very good results with that. So you can do it on a chair as well, but you have to kind of recondition yourself a bit to feel that sitting on a chair actually feels like meditation. It doesn't feel like watching the TV or whatever, right? Because usually you sit on a chair, we do all this other kind of stuff. So you have to recondition yourself a bit. Once you get into it, there's no reason why sitting on a chair cannot be used as well. I think the reason in those days why this posture was used, because that was a standard posture. Often they didn't have chairs. They had very simple lives, especially a monastic who had gone forth. You didn't carry a chair around you everywhere, right? You're wandering through the forest with a chair on your back. So you had to do things very simply as a consequence. So that was probably the reason there. So, and then you straighten your body. And, a straight body, you have more clarity. But again, it is right time and right place. First of all, you just need to relax, you need to get into the right mood, right? So if you start off by leaning back against the wall, I recommend people do that. That's a bit like sitting on a chair. If you lean against the wall, even though you're cross-legged, it makes you relax a bit more. Right? And then gradually, as mindfulness gets established, you can straighten the body. Then the straightening happens automatically. If you start off straightening the body too early, it becomes stressful, and it's not nice. So everything has to be done in the right way, right? Do things in the right sequence. Always ask yourself, are you relaxed? Are you at ease? Then you know that you're following the right instructions. If you follow the instructions blindly, without asking yourself how you experience it, then you're going to cause problems for yourself. Okay. And establishing mindfulness in front of him, right? You have to have mindfulness before you can do mindfulness of breathing. Having established it, this comes first. And this is important, and this is why one of the problems with meditation practice is that people go to the breath too quickly. You will have noticed when I did the little guided meditation, I only mentioned the breath a couple of times, because the hardest part is actually just getting the mindfulness up, being able to enjoy the present moment, having a positive attitude, being relaxed, being at ease, right? And wow, it is just so nice just to sit here, and the mind gets drawn into the present moment as a consequence. That is actually, perhaps, for most people, the hardest part. And once you get that, once that mindfulness is established, then things are relatively easy, and then you move on to the breath. And then it's very easy. It's almost as the breath is there already. You just very gently have to put your attention on it, and it happens as a consequence. And of course, a very large part of all the Buddhist practice we do, all the morality, the sense restraint, the trying to have compassion for other people, having metta, all of these things that we do in our daily practice, being charitable, being kind, being generous, and all of these kind of things, all of these things, ultimately what they do is they help you to establish mindfulness. Because you feel good about yourself, right? You feel, yes, I lived a good life. And then when you sit down, you're kind of satisfied with your own conduct. And because you're satisfied with your own conduct and with who you are, mindfulness tends to be established as a consequence. So this is the importance of morality in all this, of living a wholesome life, having a good character, having a good heart. This is so kind of fundamental. And then the mindfulness comes up. So there's two things, two ways, at least two factors to establishing mindfulness. One is the long-term practice, and one is the short-term practice you do when you sit down. And when both of those come together in the right way, then mindfulness happens. And then, when that is the case, then we can start the mindfulness of breathing. And it says here, just mindful, he breathes in. Mindful, he breathes out. Right? Just mindful. This tiny little word, just there. Eva in the Pali. Maybe, I'm not sure, sometimes it's easy to read too much into these tiny little words, and you have to be careful of that as well, but perhaps it means that mindfulness of breathing is just that. All you have to do is to be aware, right? Nothing else, no willpower, no doing. You are just mindful, just aware of the process of breathing. Just mindful you breathe in, just mindful you breathe out. Sometimes these little words can be meaningful, especially if they fit with the overall context. They can actually have some significance to them. So, now we can have a look at the actual stages of the meditation itself. So once all the basics are in place, now the meditation starts to happen pretty much automatically here. And this is how it is explained in this famous Anapanasati Sutta. Breathing in long, he knows I breathe in long. Or breathing out long, he knows I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he knows I breathe in short. Or breathing out short, he knows I breathe out short. He trains thus, experiencing the whole body, I will breathe in. He trains thus, experiencing the whole body, I will breathe out. He trains thus, tranquilizing the bodily activity, I will breathe in. He trains thus, tranquilizing the bodily activity, I will breathe out. And this first part here is equivalent to the body contemplation in the Satipatthana Sutta. Satipatthana Sutta, the focuses of mindfulness. This here is equivalent to the first aspect of that. So what is going on here? What is all this business about breathing in long and short? What it means is just that you are aware of what is going on, right? You don't have maybe a full awareness of the breath, but you have enough to know the general nature of each breath. Is it long? Is it short? Whatever. This is perhaps the most obvious quality of the breath, whether it's long or short. So you have awareness of that, right? That's really all it means. So that you are, you know, sometimes the thoughts might carry off a little bit, but quickly you come back to the breath again. So you are aware of every breath, of its main quality, whether long or short or whatever. And sometimes when you do breath meditation, the long breaths, sometimes you start off with long breaths, and then as the your breath calms down and you calm down, the breath becomes shorter sometimes. This may be the reason why it is long first and then short afterwards. This has nothing to do with controlling the breath, right? Sometimes people think, oh, I must control the breath. First long breath, then short breath. But if you do that, you're going to have a very unpleasant experience of anapanasati. It's not going to be very nice at all. The idea is just to be able to relax, sit back and enjoy, right? This is the whole point of this. So then from that, from the basic one, the next one is to experience the whole body of breath. Now, one of the differences here is that in the previous two, he knows the breath is long. And now he trains, right? You go from knowing to training. And again, it is a very small thing. It may not have any particular significance, but it may just mean that in the beginning, your mindfulness is already established, so you already are ready to know the breath. But to go beyond the bare knowing, you actually have to practice, you have to train yourself, you have to do this over a period of time, and then the full experience of the breath, experiencing the whole body, happens as a consequence of that training, of applying yourself. Again, I don't think it means that training doesn't here mean using willpower, it just means doing it again and again and again, and gradually getting into the understanding how it works, and deepening your virtue and sila and all of that at the same time. Experiencing the whole body, again, this is a difficult term to interpret. This is one of the problems, right? Everything, there's always some degree of interpretation in the suttas. So what does that mean here, experiencing the whole body? And the commentary to the sutta says it means experiencing the whole body of the breath, because the word body in Pali means like any kind of group of things, any kind of a body of evidence or something like that, just as in English, it means a mass of things. So here, I think probably the commentary is right. It probably means the whole body of the breath, the entire breath, right? The whole thing, not just knowing whether it's long or short, but you know the breath from the beginning all the way to the end. Your mindfulness is sharpening. Your ability to be in the present moment is becoming stronger. So you see more of what is going on. So it's a natural progression. Because it's called breath meditation, I think to interpret this as the actual physical body, I don't think that's satisfactory, in my opinion. Some people do that, but that is not the way I would interpret this. And I'm just following Ajahn Brahm, really. That's what he does as well. And the commentary does that, so that's pretty good, pretty strong authority right there. And then he trains in tranquilizing the bodily activity. Bodily activity, the kaya sankhara. This is a word that is used in the suttas to mean the breath, because it is an activity of the body, right? So again, you have to know these things. If you don't know this, it's very hard to... bodily activity is not obvious what it means. But that's actually what it refers to. So you tranquilize the breath. And again, it's something that happens by itself. You don't do it. You train. You allow it to happen. And by standing back, in fact, the less you do, the less activity you are involved in, the more tranquil the breath becomes as a consequence. So all you have to do is stand back. All you have to do is to enjoy it. And then tranquility happens all by itself. It's a bit strange. Why does the Buddha use different words? Why does he say first breath and then he says bodily activity and all these kind of things? Why kind of moving around like that? And I think, again, it is this idea of using different synonyms, different words that everybody knows is pointing to the same thing. It kind of strengthens the stability of the text if it's going to be memorized over long periods of time. That would be my guess for why he's using all these different words here. Okay, so that is the doing of the body contemplation, right? That's really all you have to do. If you want to do the kaya nupassana, the contemplation of the body in satipatthana, that fulfills that contemplation just by watching the breath itself. Okay, and so then let's go on to the next one. The next one is then each of these four stages here relates to one of the stages in the Satipatthana Sutta. So the next one relates to the Vedana Nupassana, the contemplation of feeling here. And this is how it works with the breath. He trains thus, experiencing rapture, I will breathe in. He trains thus, experiencing rapture, I will breathe out. He trains thus, experiencing happiness, I will breathe in. He trains thus, experiencing happiness, I will breathe out. He trains thus, experiencing the mental activity, I will breathe in. He trains thus, experiencing the mental activity, I will breathe out. He trains thus, tranquilizing the mental activity, I will breathe in. He trains thus, tranquilizing the mental activity, I will breathe out. So, a lot of similarity here with the previous tetra, the previous four steps, right? Similar kind of structure in many ways. It starts off with experiencing rapture, right? So when the breath becomes very tranquil, very peaceful, at that point often the piti will start to arise. Rapture here is piti in Pali. So it happens pretty much by itself. All you have to do is watch the breath. And at this point, the rapture will often arise, right? So here you have the roadmap, you know roughly what is supposed to happen. And if you compare this with what we were talking about on the very first day of the retreat, what I talked about as the psychology of meditation, you will see it matches those steps from the very first day, almost very, very closely. The same kind of sequence is happening here. So, again, you're experiencing rapture, right? Very strong, pleasant sensations in the body. And then as the breath, as you keep on doing, watching the breath, things become even more peaceful and quiet. And that rapture turns into a much more deeper kind of happiness, the sukha. And that's the second one here, experiencing happiness. Sukha patisangvedi, I think the Pali is there. Then it says experiencing the mental activity. Mental activity here means whatever is happening in your mind, really. But usually in the suttas it has a specific meaning of feeling and perception. There is little volitional activities left at this stage. The body is kind of fading into the background. The mind is coming to the fore now. And so you know the perceptions and feelings in the mind, right? Part of that will be the rapture and happiness. But now you kind of understand this mind state in more fully, including the remaining volition, the remaining will, which is still working a bit in the background. And then you calm that down as well, right? Just by being aware, that also is calming down even more. The tranquilizing of the mental activity either means tranquilizing the volition, or it tranquilizing the mental kind of whole mental experience. And basically it's the same thing. There's no difference between the two, really. So becoming more and more beautiful, right? At this stage, things are starting to become very nice, very pleasant. The breath is still there, but even the breath is becoming fainter, because there's so much happiness and joy coming together with the breath. So very, very beautiful things happening here. So that is the equivalent to the experience of the doing of the Vedana Nupassana of the Satipatthana Sutta, right? All this is about Vedana, it's about understanding, feeling. And here we are moving into what I was calling the Niramisa Vedana, the Niramisa Sukha, which is like the spiritual happiness, and is the opposite of the Samisa Sukha, which is more like the carnal or worldly happiness. So you see here the distinction between the two. Okay, so now after the feeling, the next Satipatthana is the Chitta Nupassana, the contemplation of mind. And so these next four levels here in the Anapanasati Sutta are equivalent to the Chitta Nupassana. Right? So now things are getting, with every stage, things are getting more deep, more profound, more otherworldly, if you like. So he trains thus, experiencing the mind, I will breathe in. He trains thus, experiencing the mind, I will breathe out. He trains thus, gladdening the mind, I will breathe in. He trains thus, gladdening the mind, I will breathe out. He trains thus, stilling the mind, I will breathe in. He trains thus, stilling the mind, I will breathe out. He trains thus, liberating the mind, I will breathe in. He trains thus, liberating the mind, I will breathe out. So here, experiencing the mind, we are kind of moving into the mental world, leaving the body, leaving the senses into the background. And this stage is probably very similar to what is often called these days kind of the nimitta experience of meditation practice, where you see a bright sun or something like that in your meditation practice, a bright light in your practice. At this point, you're moving into the world of the mind, and the physical world is being left behind. Doesn't perhaps have to be that experience, depending a bit on what you do, on how you practice, but this is certainly included, right? So this is where the world is being left behind. The mind is, only the mind remains. So you're experiencing the mind. The breath may still be there. You may wonder, why does it say, I breathe in, if we are experiencing the mind? Well, the breath, the physical world is still there in the background, but far away somewhere. So the breath is still sort of there. But sometimes it may disappear completely, and all you have left is really the mind. So it's a bit kind of varied, I think. And then you keep on staying with that, right? So once you get to the nimitta stage, once you start getting these lights in the mind, then you keep on focusing on that. So you're moving here gradually from the breath onto these other aspects of mind. And again, you don't do anything. None of this is about doing. This is just a description of what happens. Please keep that in mind. When it says with each stage that you train in this way, it doesn't mean you have to do anything. You just sit back and you watch the whole thing developing. The reason you have a description is just so that you have a map. You know that you're heading in the right direction. Right? So as long as these things are happening, you can just relax and go with the process. And as the process deepens, you go from experiencing the nimitta to it becoming more happy, right? Happier and happier and happier. You're gladdening it. As you keep the focus there, you become more and more glad. And then beyond that, you are stilling it. If there is a little bit of residual movement left in the mind, and this is the time where by keeping your focus on this, it becomes even more peaceful, even more still, right? At this point, things are really kind of becoming very, very powerful and very special in a sense. You're kind of getting, it's very easy around these days to get excited, right? To think, whoa, this is just, what is going on here? And some people say that the bliss sometimes is so great, so powerful, that you wonder where you can take all that bliss. That's what people sometimes say. There's so much bliss, I don't know if I can take it all. It's just too overpowering. So that's how powerful it can be here. So it is very, very strong around this stage. And then the very last thing, after you are stilling the mind, the very last thing we do here is to liberate the mind. And the liberating of the mind means that you are liberating it completely from the five senses, liberating it completely from the body, liberating it completely from the five hindrances. Right? So far that the senses have kind of been in the background, they have been available to you. You can turn your mind to them if you want to. At this stage, you've gone completely beyond all of that thing. The mind is liberated from that. This is one of the liberations in the sutta. There's two types of liberation. One liberation is what they call temporary liberation, the samaya vimokka or vimutti. This here is vimokka, I think. And so that is a temporary one. And then there's the asamaya vimokka, which is the non-temporal liberation, where it's permanent and it's just finished with once and for all. So here it is a temporary one. You are liberating the mind. And liberating the mind in the suttas is always really a synonym for the jhana states. Because at that point, you have gone beyond the sensory world. So this is the last thing you do, right? Allowing the mind to be liberated. Keeping your mind on the meditation object until, wow, bang, and you go into a jhana state. The world kind of, you know, whatever happens there, you know, merging with a samadhi nimitta, whatever, you're kind of entering this other world, the rupa loka, the rupa dhatu, rupa avachara is called in the suttas. You're entering like a different universe in a sense. this corresponds to the three worlds in the suttas, the Kama Dhatu, the Rupa Dhatu, and the Arupa Dhatu, right? Human beings live in the Kama Dhatu, the Dhatu, the world of sensuality, and here, for the first time, you're entering the Rupa Dhatu, the world of a luminous form, or something like that. This is a translation that Adam Sujata has been using recently for a Rupa in this context, a luminous form. And I think it kind of captures the idea quite well of what is happening at this point. So, there you are. So this shows you the progress of Anapanasati all the way to the jhana stages. This is how I read this. This is a little bit different from how the commentary reads this, I have to warn you. The commentary has some explanations which I feel they're okay, perhaps, but I feel that it misses some of the points about this, which is the gradual progression through various stages. So this is how I would interpret it, and I think this is also probably how Ajahn Brahm would interpret it, roughly, anyway. I haven't heard him explain the sutta for a while, so I'm not really sure. And so here you go, all the way to the jhana stages. And then comes the last part, and the last part now is about insight. Because at this point, it is possible to have real insights, right? Especially if you take it all the way to the jhanas. If you don't take it all the way there, you can still have lesser insights. But here they come. This is the Dhamma Nupassana, the contemplation of Dhammas, of principles, if you like, understanding the laws of conditionality, etc. And the four types of insight here are impermanence, fading away, cessation, and relinquishment. And all of that relates to the laws of causality, how things come into existence, how they pass away again, etc. So he trains thus, contemplating impermanence, anicca, I will breathe in. He trains thus, contemplating impermanence, I will breathe out. He trains thus, contemplating fading away, I will breathe in. He trains thus, contemplating fading away, I will breathe out. He trains thus, contemplating cessation, I will breathe in. He trains thus, contemplating cessation, I will breathe out. He trains thus, contemplating relinquishment, I will breathe in. He trains thus, contemplating relinquishment, I will breathe out. This is called mindfulness of breathing here. Right, so now you are looking back on the process that has happened, right? Whatever has happened in your meditation experience, you look back and you see how things, first of all, are anicca, how they have changed, right? How feelings come and go, how the body changes, and all of these kind of things. This is the basic idea of impermanence, of anicca. The movement of things, the ever-changeability of things, the lack of stability, the lack of having kind of a of always being reliable, so to speak. Yeah. And then you take the idea of impermanence further and you contemplate fading away. You see how things fade away in your mind's eye as you do the practice. Things are gradually becoming less and less, fading into the background, the breath, the body, all of these things we talked about yesterday, until eventually they cease. They disappear completely, right? This is kind of the highest degree of impermanence, of anicca, when they disappear completely out of view and you don't see them again. So all of these things you see, and each stage is a more deeper insight, a deeper understanding of reality. And when you see things ceasing completely, that is usually where the deep insights can be had as a consequence. And when you see all of this, what happens is that you start to relinquish these things. The last part here, the relinquishment here means craving itself ceasing, craving coming to an end, right? All of this stuff is unreliable. It ceases, it disappears, it is non-self, it is suffering. And for that reason, you relinquish it. You're not interested anymore, and craving comes to an end. This is the last one, contemplating relinquishment. You're giving it up, not attaching it to anymore. So this is where the deep insights come. There is some degree of insight to be had along with all the steps here about understanding what is happening, understanding the process, understanding the defilements of your mind. But the real insights come here at the very end. So these are understanding the nature of existence itself. Okay, so there you are. That's the Anapanasati Sutta, a very important sutta. one of the main practices of meditation as described in the suttas, so important for that reason here. And then the Buddha says, if Ananda, you visit the bhikkhu Girimananda and speak to him about these 10 perceptions, it is possible that on hearing about them, he will immediately recover from his affliction. Then, when the Venerable Ananda had learned these 10 perceptions from the Blessed One, he went to the Venerable Girimananda and spoke to him about them. When the Venerable Girimananda heard about these 10 perceptions, his affliction immediately subsided. The Venerable Girimananda recovered from that affliction, and that is how he was cured of his affliction. Okay, so there you are. That's the Girimananda Sutta about the 10 types of perceptions. One of those important Paritta Suttas used around the Buddhist world, and quite an interesting one. A lot of meat, a lot of interesting things coming together in one sutta, but also very profound in many places. Okay, so now we are coming to the very last sutta of this retreat, called the 10 Powers. This is from the Nidana Samyutta. So this is about dependent arising again. And this kind of just a very quick summary of what we have been doing on this retreat. Very, very brief summary. And also, what is nice about this sutta is that the Buddha kind of gives the monks like a bit of a pep talk, you know, and saying, okay, you know, do it. This is wonderful practice. It leads into such wonderful results. Get on with the practice. So it's kind of perhaps a good place to end the retreat. So let's see what the Buddha has to say. 10 powers at Sarvati. Bhikkhus, possessing the 10 powers and the 4 grounds of self-confidence, the Tathagata, the Buddha in other words, claims the place of the chief bull of the herd, roars his lion's roar in the assemblies, and sets rolling the Brahma wheel thus. Right? 10 powers of the Buddha, the 4 grounds of self-confidence. If you want to find out what they are, you can turn to Majjhima Nikaya number 12, which is the Mahatsyanada Sutta, the great discourse on the lion's roar. Majjhima Nikaya number 12, it has long discourse on all of his powers. And because he has all these powers and self-confidence, basically these self-confidences are the sort whereby he doesn't see that anyone in the world can really contradict his teachings or can prove them wrong in any way. His teachings are kind of unassailable. That's why he has this self-confidence. That's really what it comes down to. And because of that, he claims the place of the chief bull of the herd, right? Roars his lion's roar in the assemblies. The lion's roar, when the lion roars in the jungle, everybody listens, right? Everybody quivers a little bit and think, oh, we better be careful, the lion is roaring his roar. And in the same way, in the sutta, sometimes the Buddha will roar his lion's roar and the devas will start to get frightened because they will understand. We thought we were permanent, but it seems we are impermanent after all. And then they start to get a bit worried about that for obvious reasons. So it's this powerful roar, right? This amazing thing. This is the idea of the lion's roar. And it sets rolling the Brahma wheel, the highest wheel, the most powerful wheel, the highest kind of thing. And the wheel here is like this idea of you set something going. And once you set something going in the world, it doesn't stop, right? It just keeps on rolling until eventually it runs out of momentum. But it keeps going for a long time. So it's this wheel, this Dhamma, which keeps on rolling out in the world. But this beautiful wheel, related to Brahma, the Brahma world. And this is what that teaching is, right? That it sets forth. Such is form, such is origin, such is passing away. Such is feeling, such is origin, such is passing away. Such is perception, such is origin, such is passing away. Such are the willed activities. Such their origin, such their passing away. Such is consciousness, such its origin, such its passing away. So, this is the profound insight of the Buddha into the nature of experience itself, and we have been looking at that quite a bit. Thus, when this exists, that comes to be. With the arising of this, that arises. When this does not exist, that does not come to be. With the cessation of this, that ceases. This is like the short formula of dependent origination, showing you the conditionality between each of the links, right? That's the idea of that. And it also shows you that this relates back to the five aggregates. The five aggregates have also been causally arisen in this way. That is, with ignorance or with delusion as condition, there are willed activities. With the willed activities as condition, there is consciousness, etc., etc., through all the 12 links of dependent origination. Thus is the origination of this whole mass of suffering. But with the remainderless fading away and cessation of delusion comes the cessation of willed activities. With the cessation of the willed activities, there is the cessation of consciousness, all the way up to such is the cessation of this whole mass of suffering. And so here the mass of suffering is the five khandhas that we have seen before. So you can see here how the dependent arising is here applied to the five khandhas themselves. And you can see how all these teachings come together, they meet together seamlessly and become part of one big whole, which is the big insight that the Buddha had on the night of his awakening. Everything holding on together here. Because the Dhamma has thus been well expounded by me, elucidated, disclosed, revealed, stripped of patchwork. When, because the Dhamma has thus been well expounded by me, elucidated, disclosed, revealed, stripped of patchwork, this is enough for a clansman who has gone forth out of faith to arouse his energy thus. Willingly let only my skin, sinews and bones remain, and let the flesh and blood dry up in my body, but I will not relax my energy so long as I have not attained what can be attained by manly strength, by manly energy, by manly exertion. Right? This is the Dhamma stripped of patchwork. There's no excess. There's nothing useless there. It's all just the core teachings, right? The core, the essence of life, the meaning of life itself. And because this is the meaning of life, it is worthwhile even sitting down with this incredibly strong determination. Let everything just dry up, right? I'm willing to give it everything because this really is the answer to everything. And that's why I'm not going to mess around and really go for it. Setting the bar very high, right? The flesh and the blood dry up in my body. It's obviously meant metaphorically because you can't really have that happen, obviously, but still, it gives a very strong impression. Manly energy, manly exertion. Again, you know, this is this idea of strong, of being strong and energetic. I don't think it has anything to do with being male as such. It's just an idea of exerting yourself. And then the Buddha goes on, right? Because the lazy person dwells in suffering, soiled by bad, unwholesome qualities, and great is the personal good that he neglects. But the energetic person dwells happily, secluded from bad, unwholesome qualities, and great is the personal good that he achieves. It is not by the inferior that the supreme is attained. Rather, it is by the supreme that the supreme is attained. Because this holy life is a beverage of cream, the teacher is present. Therefore, because arouse your energy for the attainment of the as yet unattained, for the achievement of the as yet unachieved, for the realization of the as yet unrealized. With the thought, in such a way, this going forth of ours will not be barren, but fruitful and fertile. And when we use the robes, alms, food, lodgings, and medicinal requisites offered to us by others, these services they provide for us will be of great fruit and great benefit to them. Thus, because you should train yourself. Right? This idea that it is not by the inferior. You have to really apply yourself. You have to go for it all the way. If you are lazy, nothing is going to happen. If you're energetic, it's going to happen. The holy life is a beverage of cream. Cream is like the highest, right? The best of something. It is the best. It is the best that is available. And at that time, the teacher was still present. And because of that, it is really worthwhile striving. Yeah. You strive for your own realization, but also you remember that that realization, if you do get that, it will be of great benefit for those people who support you. And then he concludes, considering your own good bhikkhus, it is enough to strive for the goal with heedfulness. Considering the good of others, it is enough to strive for the goal with heedfulness. Considering the good of both, it is enough to strive for the goal with heedfulness. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. There you are. It's a very powerful ending there to the last one. Okay, so that's it. All the suttas are finished, and I have already gone a couple of minutes over time already. So there you are. I guess that's it. I wish you all well. Hope you all have enjoy your continuing your Buddhist practice wherever that is, and maybe we'll see you again here next year, perhaps, some of you. Very good.